Hello everyone and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. It's a huge show today. We've got two interviews. We've also got the World Cricket League Division 2 roundup and a lot of ICC news. And to join me for that, my regular co-host has come out of his cave from Heidi from all the death threats to join me, Andrew Nixon.
Hi Russ, hi everybody, and hello to all my Nepalese fans.
Andrew, we won't start with the WCL 2, we'll start with the Dubai Triangular Series, which finished a couple of weeks ago between Afghanistan, Ireland and Scotland. And I think in the last podcast we praised Afghanistan's batting. We said that they were starting to put together a more consistent lineup, but that proved to be a bit premature. They made 240 for 2 in that first game against Scotland, but they were bowled out for 63 in a huge loss to Scotland in the later game. And 180 and 246 against Ireland, which shows that they're not consistently putting on scores big enough to win with.
Yeah, that's right. They obviously heard us talking about their batting because then they decided to be rubbish. Yeah, disappointing, I suppose, for Afghanistan. They certainly need to shore up that batting lineup ahead of the World Cup. The bowling is still as good as it ever was. Hamid Hassan has been... You're back. He didn't play every match in the Tri-Series, but he played some of them, and good to see him back, of course. And the bowling, as I say, he's there, just about, but the batting, obviously, still needs some work.
And in the other matches between Ireland and Scotland, Ireland had a close win over Scotland. Both their wins for Ireland were by 3 wickets, and then there was an abandonment in the final match, which meant Ireland, in a sense, won almost by default. They may have won that match, of course, but we didn't. They won. They were in front of Afghanistan on the table, basically by winning the getting a draw in the final game.
Yeah, and that was actually the first ever washout of any ODI in the United Arab Emirates. So, of all the two teams it would happen to, it would have to be Ireland and Scotland, I suppose. A bit of a surprise there and disappointed we didn't get to see the tournament decided on the field rather than just by having an abandonment on that last day.
Scotland, they had a pretty good tournament. It seemed they scored reasonably heavy, even though they had a couple of losses. They had a big win as well.
Yeah, they certainly didn't play badly at any stage. Scored over 200 in all their matches, apart from obviously the washed out one. So, yeah, I think they can be satisfied with their performance in the Tri-Series, but it looks to us like Afghanistan, the batting needs some work ahead of the World Cup.
Yeah, all three sides perhaps that might be true of as well. There were no hundreds in the tournament at all, and so perhaps they're all looking a bit soft coming into the World Cup.
Yes, it's possible. I mean, obviously, Dubai is very different conditions than in Australia, that they're facing in Australia, so perhaps we can't read too much into it, but Dubai is normally good for batting, so it's an interesting tri-series, I suppose, as interesting as tri-series can get, and we'll see how those teams do in the World Cup, and they've had a reasonable preparation. I think they could have probably done with more games against some full members. But those games are hard to come by, as we'll come on to in a bit.
Indeed we will. The other big tournament, apart from WCL 2, was the Asian Cricket Council's T20 qualifier, which concluded with Oman winning through. Let's start with the Maldives. They've been weak in a few tournaments now, and here they were completely outclassed. The net run rate of minus 3.28 is fairly significant in a T20 tournament.
Yeah, I think the sort of nadir of their tournament was in their game against Kuwait. The last time these two teams met, of course, was in the Asian Games where Kuwait won on a coin toss. This time, Maldives scored 138 for 9, which is a perfectly reasonable score at this level, and then Kuwait sort of smashed it around a bit and chased the target down 8.5 overs. Absolutely amazing run chase as well. You look at the strike rates of the two not out Kuwait batsmen, Mohammed Irfan 63 from 26 balls and Amir Javed 55 from 18 balls. It's just quite amazing run chase.
Yeah, it's not often a side's on track to score 300 in a T20. I believe probably it's never happened. Kuwait was in fact the most interesting team in the tournament. They had a series of close matches. They ended up coming second, but in a sense, they could have ended up fourth. They won by 10 runs to Singapore, 3 runs to Saudi Arabia, by 2 wickets, again, chasing 190 against Malaysia. Finally, they fell short to Oman by only 11 runs, but in that final match, they needed 73 off the last 10 overs and 6-7 wickets in hand. Just managed to lose 5 for 19 in a key 5-over period to Amir Kaleem and Rajesh Kumar and Pura, and that was what allowed Oman to qualify.
Yeah, I think Kuwait certainly would have felt they could have won from that position, and they let Oman back into the game to some extent with the bat as well. I think Oman were, I think, 90-odd for 6 at one point and recovered to make the score they did, so they let sort of Oman back into the game twice there, and I think what really cost Kuwait was that, you know, the close nature of some of those wins, other than against the Maldives. Every win for them was close, and in the end it was net run rate that decided the winner of the tournament.
It did seem though that Oman was the best team, except for a loss to Singapore on the third day. They seemed fairly comfortable in most of their other matches.
Yeah, you know, they tended to win their games quite comfortably when they won them. They put together a couple of scores sort of approaching 200, so they're, you know, obviously a very good batting side, and yeah, I think deserved winners. At this point, do we talk about our prediction from the last episode?
We thought Malaysia would do well, and their problem was clearly their batting, their bowling, because they conceded 192 to Oman, 176 to Saudi Arabia, and were 191 plus to Kuwait. There was a few balls left remaining in that match. So clearly they were struggling with the ball, and that's what cost them.
Yeah, and you know, it's come after such a good year for them in 50-over cricket last year, and they've gone into 2020 mode early in this year, and they've not done too well. And so, you know, very unfortunate for them, perhaps. 50-over cricket is more their forte.
So Oman will go forward to the qualifier in Ireland and Scotland in July, and We'll see how they go there.
Yeah, they played in the qualifier in the UAE in 2012 and didn't do well. They lost all their first round games, and they were looking for a bit of improvement this time.
So World Cricket League Division 2, Andrew, was, as we expected, a fascinating tournament. It went into the last day and even the last handful of overs. The teams that went through were, in a sense, the teams we expected to go through, which is Namibia and the Netherlands in first and second, and more or less, we weren't too far off in the teams we thought would go down. Uganda went down, and Canada, but Kenya was perhaps almost lucky to survive. But the most interesting team in this tournament was Nepal, because if you took Nepal out of the tournament and looked at the table, then it basically runs Nepal, Netherlands, Canada, Kenya, Uganda, and they all beat the teams below them and lost to the teams above them. But Nepal managed to beat the top two teams in the tournament and lose to the sixth place team in the tournament, and the team that eventually was fourth on the table as well. So they're the strange smoky in the sense that they messed everything up and around, in and around them, because of their inconsistency, and because they're a very one-sided team in terms of being good at bowling and struggling with the bat.
Yeah, you know, the batting has always been reliant on Paras Khadka and Gyanendra Malla to some extent as well, and such was the case in this tournament. And something else I noticed during this tournament, following the games live, was that Paras Khadka was making almost the same bowling changes at almost the same time in every match. He became very formulaic, and I think where you saw that the most was in against Canada, when Canada were 22 for 5 at one point, and you know, well on the back foot, and they ended up scoring 114, certainly not a good score, but from 22 for 5, it is a good score. Yeah, fair enough, the two opening bowlers, Sampal Kami and Casey Karen, were, you know, perhaps a bit tired at that point, and so they moved out. But then once he took the sixth wicket with the score on 42, they should have brought the strike bowlers back on, try and finish off the innings quickly, and they didn't do that. They stuck with the strategy that seemed to have been decided before the match, and you know, it's not as if the bowlers were bowling slow. You know, Canada weren't really trying to score quickly. You know, Jimmy Hans was crawled to 22 from 103 balls, and Nikhil Dutta 20 from 60 balls. You know, they weren't batting well by any stretch of the imagination. But we saw it in other games as well. They were they weren't bringing back your Kami and Karan early enough to try and, you know, just get the final blow against them. And Sagar Pun was being used, and Sagar Pun wasn't bowling well in the tournament to some extent, and very formulaic captaincy, I suppose, from Kapker. And I think playing in the World Cricket League Championship, he's going to have to learn to be a bit more experimental with his captaincy, shall we say.
Let's talk about Karam and Kami, because in the past Nepal's been very dependent on their spinners, and they've obviously got these two now coming through, and it makes them a much more rounder team outside of Asia, you'd think.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. You know, this was Karan's debut for Nepal in this tournament, and you know, he did in that game against Canada bowl very well. He took 5 for 26, which we think is the first five wicket haul from a Nepali seamer in the World Cricket League since Mahbub Alam took all 10 against Mozambique back in 2008. So to see another seamer come through, you know, Kami made his debut last year, and now Karan's come through as well. And Nepal are developing their bowling attack. They've become a much more rounded bowling attack. But that batting and the captaincy to some extent certainly needs some work.
Yeah, it's similar problems we've seen in the past from them as well. And one of those problems we've seen in the past is they start tournaments slowly. And I think the Uganda match was very typical of this. They bowled them out for 146. And Uganda, we can chat about in a second, they really struggled with the bat throughout the tournament. But Nepal ended up losing that match by 2 runs. And that was essentially what cost them from being promoted automatically and going to be promoted to the ICAP.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and on that, especially coming as it did on the opening day, that was the only real shock of the tournament, the Uganda beating Nepal on that opening day, and Nepal have tended to have won over in Uganda in recent years. Obviously, they beat them quite convincingly at the World Cup qualifier last year, and Nepal perhaps in recent years have been slow starters in tournaments. We saw that World Cricket League Division 3 in Bermuda a couple of years ago. So, slow starts to tournaments has been a problem for Nepal in the past. And, such was it here, which is unusual because they had a relatively good preparation. They went on a brief tour of South Africa before playing this, which was important. As we mentioned in our preview, Nepal don't play in Africa very often. They don't play outside of Asia very often. They hadn't played in Africa since 2006. That was one game in Namibia. That was the only time they played in Africa ever. So, they did everything right. They prepared well, but then just that first game of the tournament, it just seemed to all go wrong.
And not taking advantage of being in a position to do well is something that's, again, they've had issues with. And I guess the final day showed that when they lost to Kenya, but not just lost, but lost so badly that their net run rate ended up behind, although in the end, because of the way the Netherlands played, they actually needed to win that match.
And you look at the batting lineup from the batting scorecard for Nepal in that game, you've got Gyanendra Mala on 91 not out, which is very good, but then the next highest score is Paras Katkar on 20, and you can't compete regularly with relying on just two batsmen, and Nepal need to work on that batting lineup, and they're not doing it. And then the bowling again was good, but the captaincy was predictable. Once Kenya actually getting on top of the game and scoring those runs so quickly, forced Paras Katkar to try and be more experimental with his captaincy, to try and use different bowlers at different times. But even that didn't work. You look at the bowling squad. You brought Sagar Pun on before himself. Paras Katkar had bowled very well in the sun up until that point. He'd be very economical. Sagar Pun hadn't. Sagar Pun went for 37 runs in 7 overs. And when you're trying to win a game with a low target, when you're trying to defend a low target, you don't need a bowler to do that. But Paras Katkar, he bowled his 4 overs for only 18 runs. That's a perfectly fine economy rate for the game situation. And I really don't know what he was thinking with his captaincy throughout the tournament.
let's talk about Uganda. They end up getting relegated relatively easily. The first day was, as you say, the only real upset. Their batting is also very weak, and in the end, they really didn't ever score enough runs to compete.
Yeah, this has become a habit for Uganda. They get promoted from Division 3, and then, you know, as sure as night follows day, they get relegated from Division 2, and it's happened every time. So I think, you know, this is perhaps Uganda's level, and, you know, they did well on that first day to beat Nepal. That, you know, that was more Nepal playing badly, but then throughout the rest of the tournament, they were just pretty poor, especially in that game on the last day against the Netherlands, where they were sort of bowled out for just 79.
Let's chat about the last day of that game with the Netherlands. The Netherlands put themselves in a bit of a hole because after they lost to Nepal, and they went into the last day needing a really big win to catch up to Nepal and then hope that Nepal lost. But they once again did what they needed to do just when they needed to, it seems. So they bowled Uganda for 79. They chased it in 6.3 overs. But they're an interesting side, the Netherlands, at the moment, perhaps.
Yeah, this was very much a weakened Netherlands side as well. You know, players like Tom Cooper and Van der Gooten and Michael Swart and a couple of others not available for either commitments in Australia or due to the development criteria that apply in this event. And so it was a slightly weakened Dutch side, but they did well. There was a couple of new players coming through who I think they'll be looking at to strengthen their side in upcoming years. And it's very much a transitional time for the Netherlands, you know, despite the success in the World 2020 last year. And they've had a good tournament, and they need to sort of capitalise on the success in this tournament and get their ODI status back in future.
And we should mention that Namibia, their batting, except against Nepal in the game that they lost, was pretty strong throughout. They really smashed the Netherlands in their game by 188 runs, and were pretty. Again, they beat Canada really easily as well.
Yeah, Namibia definitely the best batting lineup in the tournament. No doubt, no doubt that's due to their regular participation in 3-day cricket in the second tier South African first class competition. So, it just goes to show what we've often said in this podcast: playing the longer form can help you in the shorter form, and Namibia's batting performance in this tournament is proof of that.
And Kenya and Canada, I think they were we chose different ones to who would have gone down. I think in both cases, it wouldn't have been a surprise that if either of them would have gone down. They didn't ever really look like they're playing particularly well through the tournament, except for Kenya in the end managed to beat Nepal in a game that they needed to win, and that was what allowed them to stay up.
Yeah, until that last day, Kenya were distinctly unimpressive. They beat Uganda, but that wasn't really unexpected. But that game against Nepal, when Kenya needed to win and win big, because at one point it was looking like Canada were going to do well against Namibia. Canada had come back from 138 for 8 to score 224, and were looking very good against Namibia until Namibia sort of smashed them around a bit. So Kenya knew they needed to score their runs quickly, and they did. They chased down 195 in 35 overs, and I think it was almost exactly a year to the day earlier was when Kenya had chased down a target quickly against the Netherlands to make the Netherlands lose their ODI status. So Kenya this time chased the target quickly and did the Netherlands a favour.
And the ICC Americas again has been relegated, which is, we'd say, not surprising, but it's surprising when they're not relegated at this point, which is again a real worry for the region.
Yeah, there's now no America's team in the top two divisions of the World Cricket League. When 6 years ago there was, 7 years ago there was two teams in the top division, and now the best teams are in the third division. It's a real, we've talked about it before, but it's a real disaster for the Americas region that how they've performed in the World Cricket League in recent years.
premise down the show is the newly appointed head of cricket for QTV Sports, known mostly to our listeners as Pickle TV, as it previously was, and prolific writer and associate cricket, Tim Brooks. Welcome, Tim.
Morning, Russ. Morning, everyone.
Tim, there's quite exciting news, I guess, coming out of QTV Sports in terms of their release of the YouTube channel. Do you want to just tell us what's that's going to entail and what the plan is for it?
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Yeah, I mean, as you know, QTV Sports, the new name, have been building up our cricket coverage for some while now, and have produced such events like the T20 qualifier in 2012 and the Pakistan Ireland series, for example. And we've now got a partnership with ICC Europe, and this is part of our commitment to further developing content of associate and affiliate cricket as one of the key sports that QTV covers. So the natural progression of that was to have a dedicated YouTube channel where we can both show live broadcasts as well as other digital content that that we can record as well. So, for example, with ITC Europe, we are planning to do a little bit of content both in Denmark and Italy over the spring, just in terms of the development initiatives happening over there. We'll be able to show that kind of thing through the YouTube channel, as well as actual match broadcasts as well.
And your role on this as the head of cricket, you'll be hosting, I guess, but also behind the scenes?
Yeah, I mean, I've been leading the commentary for Freeport QTV for a number of years, so it's really just an extension of that role to incorporate a kind of strategic oversight of our cricket coverage, both in terms of the live coverage, but also in terms of sort of supporting our clients that we work very much in partnership with to sort of build their profile and help them get the messages they want to get out about their development. So it's about client relationships. It's also about building kind of a 360 degree content, if you like, so that it's not just live streaming of matches, but also supporting content around that. So, for example, giving the fans a bit more of an insight into the administration, into specific players, just to give it a bit more of an immersive output, so that the fans can really feel part of the associate game. That's really part of our ethos.
And to do that, I guess you're building up relationships with various associate members. I gather that from the press release that Scotland has come on board and quite strongly with it.
Yeah, I mean, the company is Scottish-based, so naturally we've got very strong links with them. We've had some very constructive discussions with them over the last 6 months or so. You may recall that we did provide coverage of the New Zealand A games that were shown at the Grange. It's kind of an extension of that, and obviously with Scotland appearing in the World Cup in a matter of weeks, it was a very natural thing for us to partner with them to raise the profile of their World Cup journey, if you like. And then sort of moving beyond that, their role within the HPP, the ICAP World Cricket League Championship, the details as to specifically what content will be covered is not quite finalised yet, but it's certainly a very strong relationship and one that we're looking to build on further.
And the World Cup coverage, obviously won't be broadcasting their matches, but there's a preview show going out before.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting thing for us, actually. It's really coupled with the launch of the Cricket YouTube channel. Is a show called Long Hop Down Under, which will be shooting actually at Clydesdale Cricket Club in Scotland. And it will go out as a half-hourly show before the start of the coverage of each of the Scotland games. So it will be a kind of light-hearted show. We'll have guests on from the history of Scottish cricket, but also other high-profile Scottish personalities that have an interest in cricket. And we'll just really be having a look at Scotland's chances in that particular game, previewing it, but also just having a bit of fun as well, and just giving Scottish cricket fans a kind of dedicated show for them, just to really whet the appetite before then, obviously, the live broadcast from Sky, the match itself.
So, one of the difficulties, I guess, following Associate Cricket is it's actually quite hard to get screen matches of. Certainly, World Cricket League matches haven't been screened except within Nepal in the past, and regional qualifiers there was has improved. I just see Europe has done a little bit on the regional qualifiers in the past. And you're hoping that PGB Sports would be able to fill in that breach in some way?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's reached a sort of tipping point, if you like, over about the last year, where the anticipation of fans is that, you know, a lot of matches will be broadcast. And there is that real expectation there. Now, clearly, you know, fans for us, if you like, to make sure that we work with the ICC and the associate members themselves to make sure that, you know, we can make that a reality. So, for example, if you look at World Cricket League the final, for example, I know that there was a big upset to watch that. Now, clearly there's some logistical challenges around showing that tournament, for instance, and that particular tournament wasn't tended for. But in the future, that's the kind of profile of game that we'll be very much interested in, certainly pitching for, so that we can bring that coverage of that tournament to the fans where there is clearly a demand. But if you look forward to this year, for example, we've got a very exciting tournament coming up in the T20 qualifier in the summer, and I'm sure that's something that we are definitely targeting as a key part of our plans for this year. Obviously, ICC will be to tender for that tournament. And we'll obviously put our hat in the ring and hope that our experience and our record is put us in good stead.
Yeah, I guess on that one, you're competing against the other opposite end, which is that the coverage from Sky and ESPN has been becoming more interested in associate matches, which in some ways might squeeze you, but hopefully you'll be able to find that niche.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a sort of general point. The interest in associating with the country has kind of risen, in my opinion, in kind of tandem with the success of social media. And it is very much a sort of digital platform for, as I said earlier, not just broadcasting the match, but giving a bit of an insight into the camp, if you like. So, for example, the Long Hop Down Under show that we were discussing earlier, we'll have an embedded crew within the Scotland World Cup camp, which will be recording featurettes, and then that will be included within the show. So that's the kind of example of kind of the immersive approach that we are taking. And if we can get that kind of whole package and make sure that we understand what tournaments we can bid for. And then it's just a case of working with our partners to make sure that we can do a high quality broadcast within obviously the financial constraints that might apply. So that's the challenge really, is to make sure that we can get a very high quality broadcast, make sure that we work with our clients to, you know, really understand the objectives of raising the profile of the associate affiliate game. How we can leverage, if you like, the profile of these teams and have a platform to discuss development initiatives. And then if we can do all that and have a fun show as well, then I think together, it's a successful platform for the non-profit world.
And in terms of financing at the moment, and this, I guess, goes back to what's been structured at the moment, in general, people tend to expect that the TV companies will spend possibly huge amounts of money to get the rights. But in associate cricket in general, it's almost been the opposite, hasn't it, where the ICC has funded broadcasts. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I mean, the current situation, I think, is that the ICC and associate members are very aware of the value of live TV. The budgets, of course, as you know, around associate cricket are sometimes, there's not as much money in that part of the game as there is in the test world. And therefore, you know, it has to be a very strong case for being able to broadcast. What we're doing is working with ICC and others to just really explain the benefits of doing so. And also, as I said, leaping into that real fan appetite across the world. I mean, if you look at some of the viewing figures we've had on Freeport, GTV Sports, and some of the broadcasts, they really have been exceptional. And I think, you know, perhaps surprised a few people about, you know, how many people and how many different countries across the world are tuning in.
And what are those figures sort of ballpark? Are we talking in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands?
Well, if you take, for example, the Ireland-Pakistan bilateral series that we covered in Dublin, which is, I don't know, you probably remember, and the listeners will remember, it was a very exciting series we completed with five games. We got 300,000 viewers for that pretty much series across, between 90 and 100 countries. And that was on YouTube, which is not available in Pakistan. So, you know, if you take that into consideration, you can really see the size of the potential audience.
Getting back to social media, it's something that obviously both Andrew and I have noticed that in the past we were kind of trading links to you know, very scrappy feeds from Nepal with the cricket games from there, and now it's got to the point where people do talk about social cricket. And Is that also something that has come up in discussions of not just where your broadcasting go, but what sort of matches and which teams you might actually be able to broadcast because some are obviously very popular?
Yeah, well, I think the way to think about that is this. There is a kind of existing traditional model, perhaps, which we've moved beyond now, but one where potentially full members and others may think of broadcasting an associate game as almost like a philanthropic act to try and help them out, if you like, try and help build the profile. But I think we've moved beyond that now, particularly with talk of some of these leading associates being potentially lucrative markets for cricket. And in Nepal is a good example. There is, as you know, a passionate following for cricket in Nepal. I understand that quite a few Nepalese listeners for this particular podcast, and you know, clearly if that can be tapped into, there is an opportunity not only to if you like feed the understanding and interest of that fan base, but also surely in the midterm particularly lucrative market for the ICC. And that should be one of the reasons why the development program has a focus to identify these countries and really make sure that it's doing everything it can to build up an interest, as well as build up the quality of the cricket and the infrastructure and the participation numbers. It's all part of a coherent strategy, in my view, and I think QTV Sports can play a key role in that.
Stick with Nepal. I know you wrote the chapter on Nepal in the second one, which we chatted on about last week on the podcast. Tell us a little bit about that chapter and your motivations for it.
Yeah, well, firstly, I was delighted to be approached to write the chapter. I know you've had Tim and Peter on talking about the book in general. I think they were keen to include Nepal just because of some of the factors we just discussed about it being, you know, a real emerging force in the cricket world. And just, the, you know, the passion of the fans is legendary. So I wanted to just briefly stretch out the history of Nepalese cricket, which is quite a young game in a sort of structured way anyway. Only really played their first tournament in 1996, so it's very different from the Dutch, for example. But perhaps has more in common with Afghanistan in that regard. And I just wanted to look, they've had some real ups and downs in their development, and they've also got some unique challenges with trying to establish the game in Nepal in terms of, you know, geography, in terms of infrastructure. And they've had some very interesting, moments and anecdotes along the way. So it's really just a combination of a thorough assessment of the history of Nepalese cricket, my view on, you know, what the next steps are for them to, become, well, firstly into the high performance program and really push maybe Ireland and Afghanistan to be, you know, top dogs in the associate world. What are the constraints which may prevent them doing so? But then also, you know, hopefully some light-hearted moments as well about some insights into the players, looking at a few of the historic matches, and also some of the perhaps less savoury elements, like the you know, the riot they had in the World Cricket League when they hosted it, and trying to find that balance between the enthusiasm of the fans and perhaps just drawing short of over-exuberance also.
And the news has come through this week that they'll be part of the World Cricket League Championships, having come forth in the WCL 2. So I guess you'll get to hopefully commentate on them, and perhaps QTV be even looking to go to Nepal to broadcast games, if that was an option.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, the first thing to say, my first ever cricket after what I wrote was about Nepal, so I sort of personally had quite a long involvement. And I had actually got an invitation to go to Nepal to go into a chat show, which is hosted by Vinod Das, who I'm sure you'll remember as a key player and now is assistant national coach. So I'm hoping to do that at some point. And in terms of QTV Sports, yeah, we definitely identified Nepal as a big market for us in terms of the international market. Clearly, we're a European-based company, and we look to be the sort of go-to provider for Europe specifically. But also reaching out to those other emerging nations, and Nepal are definitely in that category. And I think my sort of experience of writing this chapter and just as a cricket writer, you know, fits in well with that ambition.
Thanks for coming on, Tim.
Yeah, no problems.
Turning to news, Andrew, there was a fairly significant ICC meeting during the week, and a number of announcements came out of that, a few surprising announcements came out of that, and one we were expecting was that the iCup would be eight teams, the two teams that were the top two in WCL 2, which is Namibia and the Netherlands, and the other six teams that were had one-day status. But the surprise was the World Cricket League Championship, which had been rumoured to be expanding but then denied, is not expanded but is in fact lost Ireland and Afghanistan and been replaced by Nepal and Kenya.
Yeah, so we'll start with the replacement of Ireland and Afghanistan in the World Cricket League Championship with Nepal and Kenya. I received more than one denial that it was anything other than the top two going to the World Cricket League Championship, and I know other people did as well. It does smack a little bit of changing the rules of a tournament after it's finished. From what I heard at all the team meetings, the teams are all told only the top two go through, but apparently there was this murmur that maybe or maybe four are going to go through, and but it was denied on multiple occasions by people who should have been in the know, shall we say. And they've added Nepal and Kenya all of a sudden, and you're not to say Nepal and Kenya don't deserve to be playing in this tournament, but it to some extent takes away from what was a pretty thrilling last day of round robin playing World Cricket Division 2.
Yeah, I'm not sure that knowing it would have affected the last day results, given that both teams were fighting off relegation as well as looking for promotion, but it you're quite right. It certainly, these things should be decided before the tournament.
Yeah, every team in a tournament should know exactly what the results of the tournament mean and count towards, and in this case they didn't because they changed it after the tournament.
And it's not the first time this has happened either, right? It should be added in a number of occasions where it's been changed either straight after or extraordinarily close to a tournament or during the qualification process. I think the World Cricket League Championship wasn't expected to be World Cup qualifier when that began last round of it, which caused some consternation amongst a couple of teams.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Netherlands in their first matches in the World Cricket Championship fielded a weak and seed side because they didn't think it mattered for anything. But then all of a sudden after those games, it's actually this is a World Cup qualifier, and obviously, you know, had the Netherlands won those games, and maybe they would have finished in the top two and gone straight to the 2015 World Cup, and they wouldn't have lost their ODI status, and we all know what happened at the World Cup qualifier with them last year. And these things need to be decided far enough in advance so that teams can adequately prepare. And currently they seem to be decided on something of an ad hoc basis, and that's something I think needs to change. Other sports, the teams will know exactly their route to the World Cup, and in cricket, the teams don't, and to some extent we still don't know. There's still a bit of mystery around exactly how the World Cup qualifier will work in future.
The other issue I think with splitting the two up is that the scheduling is going to be very interesting, because now we've got a situation where some teams are playing I-Cup games but not World Cricket League Championship games, and World Cricket League Championship games and not I-Cup games, which in the past had been put together. So it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the problems around that will be related to cost. You know, the ICC don't fund all the travel costs and all the hotel costs, so there's an additional cost for those teams, and and it's not just the teams, it's your umpires. You know, the umpires who umpired Intercontinental Cup games would umpire the World Cricket League Championship games and so on. There's a lot of potential logistical problems around this, and we don't really know how they're going to be overcome yet.
Let's move on to the lucky two, I guess you'd say, in the sense of Ireland and Afghanistan. It's not necessarily clear that they are that fortunate, because it depends a lot on whether or not, for starters, that they'll get games. But they have, at least in theory, been offered the opportunity to qualify directly for the World Cup if they can get their rankings above the teams above them and get into the top eight of this, now what is essentially a 12-team league with a league without an even scheduling, but a league.
Yeah. Where do we start with this? Firstly, there's 16 teams with ODI status, but only 12 can qualify for the rankings. That's not fair. What is it about the ICC that they're completely incapable of coming up with a ranking system that covers all their teams? And
by all those teams, by the way, it should be all the teams. Like, it should be all 106 members, not even just like 16 or 20. It's not that complicated. Other sports manage it.
Yeah, this is just the rankings for one day international cricket, all one day international cricket, fair enough. Include all the one day international teams, and you're not doing. And I really just can't figure out what's up with that. And if they've picked Ireland and Afghanistan, if one of the other associates had been in the rankings previously, and all of a sudden they'd been kicked out, they'd be furious at this stage. They might even have been ranked above Ireland and Afghanistan, I'm really struggling to understand why they would do something like that. Say, oh yeah, we're adding Ireland and Afghanistan to the ODI rankings, and isn't that great? Well, first, they were already on the ODI rankings. Second, there's four other teams with ODI status. Why can't they play on the rankings?
I suspect, actually, at the moment, Papua New Guinea is probably the highest ranked associate, if they've been on the rankings, because they've won all their one day matches that they've actually played. But you're quite right. The rankings themselves have various problems, and this may end up coming into place when we actually get to the point where teams are selected on the rankings for qualification, because they are actually a little bit unstable and a little bit dependent on recent results. And that'll be a particular issue if Ireland and Afghanistan aren't playing very many games. They may just have a couple of good games or bad games at the wrong time that'll cost them or help them.
Yeah, I saw one calculation that said that for Ireland to get into ninth place by the end of this year, they'd basically have to win the World Cup, which gives you an idea of the scale of the task that they have. And Warren Dutram has said he's putting his trust in the full members to give them the matches, and it's not as if they have a good record at being able to trust the full members.
Yeah, Dutram's statements came out as very much we expect this now because this is what's happened. He was obviously quite heavily involved in bringing this about, because he's on the committees in the ICC, so he's in a sense putting Ireland ahead of some of the other associates, which makes me a little bit uncomfortable. It feels a little bit like it's pulling the ladder up behind them to try and get a particular status for Ireland that he thinks is the best that the ICC will offer them.
Yeah, I think there's an element of divide and conquer behind this strategy, and there's another aspect to to Ireland and Afghanistan not playing in the World Cricket League Championship we need to talk about as well, which is your Nepal and Kenya. They're added to the World Cricket League Championship. Oh, you're not actually playing the best two teams in it. So, Nepal v Afghanistan would be a huge fixture. Your Nepal v Afghanistan in Kathmandu with your 15,000 people at the ground, that would be a great advert for Associate Cricket, and that's being taken away from Nepal and Afghanistan fans and from us neutrals.
And also, it's essentially giving a permanent ranking to Ireland and Bangladesh, Ireland and Afghanistan, who in the past it was a bit of a silly system, but an associate needed to have won a certain percentage of games to get on the ranking table, and now we're basically assuming that Ireland and Afghanistan are, for the next basically 3 years, would be the best two associates. And I think, as Peter Belpenner rightly pointed out in his article, that's not necessarily the case. And even recent matches with Scotland that we talked about earlier, it wasn't necessarily the case that they were clearly the best two teams there, and it won't necessarily be the case in the 3 years' time that Ireland and Afghanistan are the best two teams.
Yeah, we saw what UAE did against Afghanistan in their most recent series. You won the series 3-1. So, there's an element throughout cricket of trying to put a line on where the line in the sort of list of teams, saying everybody above this line is better than everybody below that line, and it's not as simple as that. The teams at rank 13 can always beat the teams ranked at 12, and But cricket seems to struggle with this concept to some extent. And we should also, there's another thing around this, that there's a promotion and relegation system involved in the World Cricket between the World Cricket League Championships and ODI ranking table, which apparently is meritocratic. Of only two of the teams on the ODI table are eligible to be relegated. The 10 full members cannot be relegated to the World Cricket League Championship. So Ireland and Afghanistan could hypothetically be ranked first and second, but Afghanistan would be facing relegation. Now, if that's not meritocracy, it's protectionism.
Well, obviously, given that the playoff is presumably only one or two, maybe three games, it may only be a single game, it's also entirely possible that a team could qualify for and win the World Cup and then still be relegated because they lose a playoff, and they hadn't actually, when they qualified for the World Cup, been the bottom of the two associates. So obviously that's pretty unlikely, but it does indicate that it's a little bit of a partly obviously unfair, but also a little bit sort of silly system when you're putting relegation in place that only affects two of the teams involved in the tournament.
Yeah, it's completely unfair, and I'm amazed that even the ICC had the balls to claim this was meritocratic.
Talking a bit about relegation promotion as well, and we also should mention the World Cricket League, how this is going to feed into it, because in the past the World Cricket League has been run over every 2 years, and then it's the winners of those, the World Cricket League Division 2, have moved up into the World Cricket League Division 1 or the I-Cup. If this is going to run over 3 years, what is the next promotion cycle for World Cricket League teams, and how is a team going to move from World Cricket League 3 into World Cricket League 2 or World Cricket League 2 into the I-Cup, and is it even possible for the next 3 years for teams that are ranked further down the rankings to make that transition?
Yeah, the press release is rather quiet on this. It says that at the cut-off date of the rankings, which I think is the end of September of 2017, the top 8 teams go to the World Cup, then the bottom 4 teams will play in a World Cup qualifier, which will be a 10-team event. But it doesn't say how the other 6 teams in that World Cup qualifier are decided. Is it the top 6 of the World Cricket League Championship, in which case it means that, for Canada, Uganda and everybody down, qualification for the 2019 World Cup is shut? Or does it mean that there's going to be, at some point, the bottom X amount of teams in the World Cricket League Championship go into World League Division 2, and there'll be another Division 3 tournament with teams qualifying from a Division 2 tournament into the World Cup qualifier. There's a lot of ways it can do it, but the teams need to know their route to the World Cup. It's a basic principle that if you can qualify for a World Cup, you need to know... Well, first you need to know if you can qualify for a World Cup, and then you need to know how do you qualify for the World Cup. It's basic common sense and fairness that teams should know the answers to those questions.
And also, I guess, is one I hinted is what's the actual time frame for the World Cricket League over the next few years, is it still a two-year cycle, or is it moved into a three- or a four-year cycle? Because if it's a three-year cycle, we've essentially lost another 50% of the cricket played at that level, because it's now going to be such a long time between events.
Yeah, and you know, what will the future of the World Cricket League be? Is it going to stay at six divisions? We were expecting, to some extent, an announcement of who will be hosting World Cricket League Division 6 out of this. I heard murmurs of Brisbane at one point. I heard murmurs of a joint bid between Guernsey and Sussex. But nothing came out of this meeting about who was hosting World Cricket League Division 6. Maybe it was discussed and they just don't think it worth telling us about it. Or maybe it was discussed and decided, oh, no, let's not bother with World Cricket League Division 6, and, you know, which was the rumour a couple of years ago. And, you know, the whole thing is up in the air, and because, you know, the ICC doesn't really think that this stuff matters, we don't get to know about it, and we're left just asking questions. And it's not just us asking questions, it's the actual teams and associate and affiliate cricket boards themselves asking questions. Nobody seems to know the exact situation.
I guess a good segue into the other issue, which is the spare scarcity of regional tournaments over the next year. It's, again, still a little bit unclear what's going to happen with the regional offices. That wasn't announced, not that we'd probably expect it to be in the press release. But you've sent some emails around to the regional offices asking about their tournaments, and I think found that there's, I guess, not that many.
ICC Africa has two tournaments this year. It will be an under-19s and a men's division 1. East Asia Pacific has 3, which would be their under-19s. Then the Pacific Games, which will have a men's and a women's tournament, of which the women's tournament is apparently a qualifier, part of the pathway to the Women's World Cup. Europe has 3, and then a youth challenge series, which isn't really a tournament. And America's hasn't replied to my email, but as far as I know, they've just got an under-19s and men's division 1. And the ACC 2020, which we talked about earlier, is apparently their only scheduled tournament this year. You know, the ACC has always been the region with the most tournaments, but it seems to only have that one, you know, no youth tournament. So, you know, hopefully that will change, but that just makes 11 tournaments in all. You go back, you know, just, you know, 6 years ago to 2009, Europe alone had 11 tournaments that year, and now there's 11 regional tournaments full stop, and most teams aren't even playing in them, and it's a very very disappointing to see how it's declined, and from what we hear, it's going to decline even more in future.
Yeah, the lack of women's tournaments is a particular worry, given what happened in the Americas. It seems that apart from the EAP one, there would be none except for the World 2020 qualifier this year, which makes you wonder what's happening to women's cricket and associate regions if that's all the ICC is going to organise.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully the countries can organise some of their own matches as they've been forced to in the last couple of years. And but I think, you know, these pathway events are perhaps an easier sell to government investment and to sponsors, and you're sponsoring our team to play in a World Cup qualifier is a bit more appealing than you're sponsoring our team to just play this random tournament. So there's the ability to have these pathway events, you know, helps sell the game to people who aren't perhaps aware of it.
The other snippet of news on the ICC press release that is, again, a little bit vague. We talked about this in the last episode, and there was a clarification about it after, which is that USACA's status seems to be a bit on the air. The press release indicated that there was quite a long discussion about USACA's status, and they were asked to clarify against the membership criteria for the next meeting. So they're obviously on shaky ground at the moment with the ICC, if that's coming out.
Yeah, and if it's been discussed at ICC board level rather than at the associates and affiliates meetings or development committee meetings, it's obviously a pretty serious state of affairs now, and they've been asked to provide evidence that they meet the criteria, and it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. Watch this space, and I'm sure this won't be the last we hear of the USACA problem.
And there was a little bit of good news for a few players amongst the Associate World getting opportunities to match against better opposition? Legacy Siaka was selected for the PM's 11 that was played in Canberra against England as a warm-up for England's tour. He had quite a good game, but it was probably perhaps obvious to the captain who wasn't very familiar with him as a player because he got a number of overs bowling and was batted quite down the order, but had to come in and kind of have a bit of a slog when chasing more than 12 and over, which he did well for a brief period, but it's not the best way to show off your talents.
No, yeah, like I say, Siaka isn't a number 7 batsman. He's an upper order batsman. Had he been batting earlier in the Prime Minister's 11 innings when Glenn Maxwell was smashing it around, that could have been potentially a good partnership, but you know, he came in at the end when they were well behind the required race and had to slog, and you know, he got 27 from 15 balls. You know, it was only him and Glenn Maxwell who managed to score it better than a runner ball. So you know, he did reasonably well with the bat in his brief appearance, and you know, he bowled 5 overs. He's not really a bowler, and you know, he had the best economy rate of any of the Prime Minister's 11 bowlers. So you know, it's something for him to take. But he took a catch as well. He got Moeen Ali out off the bowling of Maxwell, so he would have enjoyed his experience, and I think they could have used him a bit better.
And other news: Daniel Dorham of the Netherlands and Jonty Jenner of Jersey have been picked up by the Sussex Academy, and a number of Nepalese players are playing for MCC Young Cricketers, and a few others are going to Sri Lanka to play some 3-day games, which would be great preparation for them for some of the longer formats. Although Nepal won't be getting to play in the I Cup, unfortunately. But again, it's good for those players to see, particularly Dorham and Jenner.
Dorham has been on the sort of books at Sussex for a while now, and obviously Jenner's been, you know, he's been a very talented player at youth level. You know, he played for the Jersey senior side at just 15, so he's obviously a very talented player, and hopefully we can perhaps see them, if not breaking through to the Sussex first 11 this year, then you know, playing some second 11 county cricket and developing that way. But hopefully within that, they are still available for international representation. So that's always a question with English counties. And you know, the other players, obviously, you know, a couple of players signed up for the MCC Young Cricketers. I don't think they've signed up for the full season. I think they've just been playing a small amount of it. There's the Nepalese players playing in Sri Lanka. Nepal not playing 3-day cricket, obviously, internationally, but you know, I'm never going to say it's a bad idea for your associate players to be playing the longer form of the game. I think it helps develop their game in the limited overs formats that they tend to play in internationally. So, you know, it's good news for them. Paris Kadkar is playing for the MCC in the Emirates T20, which is a pre-season tournament for involving the MCC and three English county sides. So, very good experience for all those players.
Looking ahead, Andrew, is an under-19 African tournament being played shortly. It'll involve 6 teams: Uganda, Kenya, Namibia, Botswana, Nigeria, and the hosts Tanzania, with the top team going through the under-19 World Cup and the second team to the repechage, I believe.
That is the case. Unusually for Africa, we found out this tournament, you know, quite far in advance. It starts in 2 weeks. We found out about it about 2 weeks ago. So a month in advance is very good for ICC Africa. Well done to them for that. Whether we'll find out anything about the tournament as it's being played is another question. Looking at the teams, you know, you've got to look at Namibia to some extent. They've got a very good youth set up there now, and Kenya and Uganda, you know, Kenya probably falling back a bit. Uganda, you know, I'm not too sure about the state of their youth system at the moment, but I think they'll probably be pushing Namibia for the title, and one of those two teams will probably end up in the repechage.
We might actually have to make ICC Americas our whipping boy, given their recent tournament performance and the state of the news information.
I think that is the case now. I think the Americas have dropped down below Africa in the communication stakes.
And the other, fairly minor by associate standards, is only 4 teams involved, but it is the ICC World Cup, and starts in a couple of weeks, so we should preview how the various teams are going there.
Yeah, we'll start with Group A. The associates in there are Scotland and Afghanistan, with full members being Australia, Bangladesh, England, New Zealand and Sri Lanka. So you think that both associates will be targeting Bangladesh. Both have recent wins over Bangladesh, Afghanistan in one-day cricket, Scotland in 2020 cricket. So that'll be a target for them. And, you know, I have to say, as you know, a pessimistic Englishman, that they'll probably be targeting the game against England. England always have one slip-up in the World Cup, so it's probably going to be against Scotland or Afghanistan. Probably against Scotland. It's a pretty strong group, actually. It's probably the stronger of the two groups.
Yeah, Scotland have one thing in their favour. They have actually quite good travel arrangements. They're in New Zealand or Hobart for all their matches. It's relatively... They should be able to go through the tournament in conditions that they're relatively familiar with. And perhaps, I think, even Sri Lanka, they might be able to maybe target if they have a good day. Against the two hosts, that's obviously a more difficult proposition, beating anyone away from home's always difficult, but they did well against New Zealand in a recent match there that was almost a full-strength New Zealand side.
Yeah, so obviously Scotland, that will give Scotland a lot of confidence as they head into New Zealand, but New Zealand, if it's a World Cup, they assume though they're going to be taking it a little bit more seriously than just a random warm-up game, so it's going to be a tough issue. But as you said about Scotland's sort of travel regions, like Ireland and the other group, where they're just bouncing about all over the place, Scotland, you know, relatively stable for their travel, which will help. Which is, you know, is bound to help their performance. You know, the less travel time you have to do, the better you are, the more time you have to prepare for matches and to train and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about the World Cup, there is always a long time to prepare for matches because they're so spread out. But Afghanistan have a horrible travel arrangements by contrast. At one point, they go from Dunedin to the Wacker and then back to Napier in the last and the first in New Zealand. So that's a five-hour time difference or something like that as well. They're playing Bangladesh first up, though, which means that they're hopefully, if they get off to a good start in the tournament, that might be a good way to surprise Bangladesh. And England last, if England's qualified, they might take it easy or so forth. So Afghanistan will have opportunities to get wins, you'd think.
Yeah, and, you know, As we've already said, Afghanistan have a very good bowling attack and a bowling attack that could be well suited to Australian conditions.
Group B is Ireland and the UAE playing against the other five full members, South Africa, India, Pakistan, West Indies and Zimbabwe. Ireland, I guess, first.
Yeah, Ireland haven't had the best preparation. They've got a couple of players out injured. Obviously, Tim Murtagh, probably the most worrying. Tim Murtagh, you know, very talented bowler in county cricket, and you know, he would have been looking forward to appearing on the World Cup stage. This was probably his last chance to appear at a World Cup, maybe Ireland's last chance to appear at a World Cup. But yeah, very unfortunate for him. Ireland's batting, I think, is a little more stable than their bowling, so they'll need to bat well if they're to win these games. I think both Ireland and the UAE will certainly be targeting Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe by far the weakest of the four members these days. But West Indies, you know, we don't know what West Indies team will turn up, you know, and we sometimes don't know if West Indies will turn up, as India found out recently. If West Indies play at their worst, they're vulnerable. If West Indies play at their best, then they could like the flow with Ireland and the UAE is very hit and miss, and you know, Pakistan can sometimes be the same way. You know, we saw in the last World Cup that Pakistan at one point were really on the back foot against Canada, and Canada played terribly in that World Cup. So you sort of never know with Pakistan and the West Indies. But India and South Africa are certainly probably out of the reach of Ireland and the UAE, unfortunately.
Yeah, Ireland have an interesting, I think we already mentioned their travel, but they start with the West Indies and they've got like a 9-day break until they play the UAE. So if they can do well in their first two games, they've got a number of games where they really only need one upset potentially to make the quarterfinals. So they'll definitely have a good show. They'll finish with Pakistan. UAE starting with Zimbabwe, so again, good chance, much with as with Afghanistan playing Bangladesh, to get a team that hasn't perhaps warmed up as well as they might have.
I think if you target that first game, you can get off to a good start that can give you some confidence for the rest of the tournament. And Afghanistan in their group and UAE in this group, they've got a good chance to get off to that good start.
We'll convene again on the World Cup, probably, because it lasts for several months, it seems, several years. I believe the 2007 World Cup is still ongoing, so we'll see how the teams are against you as the tournament progresses.
Yes, we certainly will.